Hey everyone, welcome back for another deep dive. Today we're going to be tackling something that I think a lot of us just kind of take for granted. You know, it's something we hear about all the time, but don't always understand the nitty-gritty of.
Sounds intriguing already. What's on the docket today?
We're going deep into the legal foundation of federal firearms laws.
Ah, that's a big one. Definitely a topic with lots of layers.
Exactly. And to really get into those layers, we're going to be focusing specifically on Chapter 44 of Title 18 of the United States Code.
Chapter 44. Okay. For those of us who aren't legal scholars, is that what most people call the Federal Firearms Act?
You know, it's funny you say that. A lot of people, DO, refer to it as the Federal Firearms Act. But that specific title doesn't actually appear anywhere in the law itself.
That's interesting. So right off the bat, we're already dealing with some common misconceptions. I can see why you picked this for a deep dive.
Yeah, and it gets even more interesting when you start looking at the history of this chapter, where it's located in the U.S. Code, and how the wording has changed over time.
Okay, I'm all ears. Lay it on me.
Well, think about this. Most people, when they hear federal gun laws, they think about the Commerce Clause in the Constitution.
Right, the part that gives Congress the power to regulate trade between states. Makes sense, since guns are often bought and sold across state lines.
Exactly. But here's the thing. The deeper we dug into the legal analysis of Chapter 44, the more we started to question if the Commerce Clause is really the whole story. There might be more to it than meets the eye.
Ooh, I love a good legal mystery. What did you find?
Well, to really understand what's going on, we need to go back in time a bit. The Federal Firearms Act, which later became Chapter 44, was originally passed back in 1938.
1938, okay. So quite a while ago. What was the legal landscape like back then?
Back then, it was actually part of Title 15 of the U.S. Code.
Title 15, which is all about commerce and trade, right?
You got it. So at first glance, it seems pretty logical for a law about firearms to be there, right? Guns are being traded between states, so it fit under the whole commerce thing.
Yeah, that makes sense. So what changed?
Well, fast forward to 1968, and boom, the act gets moved to Title 18.
Hold on, Title 18, that's the one about criminal law, isn't it?
Bingo. So we've got this law about firearms, which most people assume is about interstate commerce, suddenly landing in the section of the legal code that deals with crimes.
That's a pretty big shift. Did the legal experts you were reading offer any insights into why that happened?
Oh, yeah, they had a lot to say about it. The analysts suggested that moving the act from Title 15 to Title 18 could actually blur the original purpose and limitations of the law.
Okay, help me unpack that. What do you mean by blur the purpose and limitations?
Well, think about it this way. When it was under commerce and trade, it was pretty clear that the focus was on regulating how firearms were moving between states.
Right, classic Commerce Clause stuff.
Exactly. But when you stick it under criminal law, it creates this impression that the federal government might have a broader power to regulate firearms in general, not just when they're crossing state lines.
I see where you're going with this. The placement of the law within the U.S. Code can actually influence how people perceive its power and scope. Yeah. It's like a subtle framing technique.
Exactly. And this brings us to another really interesting point. And this one is kind of a head-scratcher.
Hit me with it.
So remember how I said Chapter 44 is what people often call the Federal Firearms Act? Well, one of the things that makes it so tricky is that Chapter 44 actually has its own special definition of interstate or foreign commerce.
Wait, what? Its own definition? Different from the standard definition in Title 18.
Yep, you heard that right. And it's this subtle difference that really throws a wrench in the whole thing.
Okay, I'm officially intrigued. What's the special definition, and how does it differ from the regular one?
Well, the regular definition, the one used everywhere else in Title 18, is pretty straightforward. It's basically just commerce happening between states, territories, you know, the usual stuff.
Right, the kind of commerce that would clearly fall under the Commerce Clause.
Exactly. But Chapter 44 throws in this extra little phrase that, on the surface, seems pretty minor, but actually has huge implications. They add any place in a state to their definition.
Any place in a state.
It does seem vague.
Yeah.
It could literally be anywhere.
And that vagueness is exactly why it's so important. This little addition changes how we have to interpret the reach of federal firearms laws.
Okay, I'm following you. Yeah. So how do we make sense of this seemingly random addition? Did the analyst offer any clues?
They did, and it involves a bit of a legal treasure hunt, connecting the dots between different parts of the U.S. Code.
Ooh, a treasure hunt.
Mm.
I'm always up for a good legal adventure. Lead the way.
All right, so let's start with that phrase, any place in a state. which comes from Section 921 of Chapter 44, where they define all the terms. Now hold that thought while we jump over to Section 13 of Title 18.
Okay, Section 13, got it. What's over there?
Section 13 is all about the special places within states where the federal government has special authority. Ah, so like federal buildings, military bases, national parks, places that are technically within a state's borders, but are under federal control.
You got it. And Section 13 points us to Section 7, which gets even more specific and defines something called the Special Maritime and Territorial Jurisdiction of the United States.
Special Maritime and Territorial Jurisdiction. Wow, that's a mouthful. What does it mean in plain English?
It's basically a list of all the places that are under the exclusive control of the federal government, even though they're physically located within a state.
Okay, I think I'm starting to see the pieces of the puzzle come together. But how does this connect back to Chapter 44 and its strange definition of interstate commerce?
Well, remember that phrase, any place in a state.
Hmm.
The legal analysts argue that it's actually referring to these specific federal areas within states.
So it's not just any random gas station or park. It's specifically about those federally controlled places.
You nailed it. It's not about regulating general commerce between states. It's much more likely that it's focused on commerce that's happening either between these federal places within a state or are between a federal place and somewhere outside of that state.
Wow, that is a super important distinction. It completely changes how we understand the scope of federal firearms laws. And it means that their power to regulate firearms isn't just coming from the Commerce Clause, but also from their power to control the specific federal territory.
Exactly. And this actually ties back to a very specific part of the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17.
Oh yeah, I remember that one from my civics class. It gives Congress the power to make laws for federal territories and places the government buys for things like forts, arsenals, dockyards, all those government-owned places.
Yep, that's the one. So basically, a lot of the legal basis for Chapter 44 could be about the federal government exercising its power over these specific areas within states. It's not just about regulating interstate commerce. It's about Congress flexing its muscles on federal land.
Wow, this is getting really interesting. But it also raises a big question. If this territorial power is the real foundation of Chapter 44, why not just say that in the law? Why all this roundabout talk about interstate commerce if it's not really the main point?
That's what makes it so fascinating. It's almost like they're trying to make the law seem broader and more far-reaching than it actually is.
You know, the legal analysis we've been looking at actually uses the term red herring to describe the way Chapter 44 defines interstate or foreign commerce.
A red herring. Like the literary device that distracts you from the real issue.
Exactly. It seems important at first glance, but it leads you down the wrong path. It distracts from the real foundation of the law, which might actually be about jurisdiction over specific areas.
So you're saying the wording of Chapter 44 could be intentionally misleading?
I wouldn't go that far. But it definitely creates confusion and obscures the true scope of the law.
Okay, so we've uncovered this hidden territorial basis for federal firearms laws, or at least that's what the analysis suggests. But wait, there's more. This whole thing about parts of the original Federal Firearms Act being omitted when it was moved to Title 18, that's a whole other rabbit hole.
Omitted? You mean they just disappeared?
Well, not exactly disappeared. They weren't repealed or officially removed from the law, but they were literally left out when they printed the revised U.S. Code.
So there are these ghost clauses floating around in the legal ether, potentially still affecting things even though nobody can see them in the official text.
That's one way to put it. And one of these phantom pieces of the law deals with something called the presumption from possession, which could have a big impact on how cases are handled in court.
Okay, now you've really got my attention. Presumption from possession. That sounds ominous. What does it mean?
Well, we don't have the exact wording because it's not in the printed code anymore. But based on how legal language usually works, the analysts think it probably created what's called a rebuttable presumption.
Rebuttable presumption. Okay, so that means?
It means that if someone's found with a firearm or some other item that's regulated under Chapter 44, the government can automatically assume or presume that they got it through interstate or foreign commerce.
Even if there's no actual proof.
Even if there's no proof. That's the presumption part. It's like they're guilty until proven innocent, in a way.
Wow, that seems like a big deal. But if this clause isn't even printed in the U.S. Code anymore, how can people defend themselves against this presumption?
That's the problem. If they don't know this hidden clause exists, they might not even realize it's being used against them in court. It raises some serious questions about fairness and transparency.
Absolutely. And it highlights how crucial it is to understand the full history of these laws, not just what's conveniently presented in the current version. Who knows what other legal gems might be lurking in the shadows?
Exactly. This deep dive has already revealed so much, and we're just scratching the surface.
I'm already eager to hear what else you've uncovered. This is fascinating stuff.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground just now, so let's take a moment to let it all sink in. When we come back, we'll discuss what this means for us, how it affects our lives, and what we can do about it. Stay tuned.
Sounds good. I'm ready for round two.
All right, so we just went through a lot of legal details about Chapter 44. Kind of a whirlwind tour of the U.S. Code, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, we've definitely been jumping around those sections, but I think it's been really helpful to see how it all connects.
Absolutely. But now I'm thinking about our listeners who, maybe aren't legal experts. They're probably wondering what this all means for them in their everyday lives.
Right. We don't want to get lost in the legal jargon. It's important to bring it back down to earth and talk about what this means for regular people, how it affects their lives.
Exactly. So let's try to connect the dots. For example, we talked about how the reach of federal firearms laws might be more limited than many people assume. Does that change how we think about local gun control efforts?
You know, it really does. If much of the federal power comes from their control over federal territories, as we discussed, then it means that states and local communities actually have a lot more responsibility for regulating firearms in those areas that aren't under federal control.
So even though we started with this big federal law, we're actually ending up with a focus on local action.
In a way, yes. This isn't to say that federal laws are important. Of course they are. Especially when it comes to preventing gun trafficking across state lines or regulating certain types of firearms, things that have a clear interstate element.
Right, those things need to be addressed at a national level.
Absolutely. But understanding the limits of federal power in this area also highlights the importance of focusing on what we can do within our own communities.
So what are some concrete things people can do to get involved at the local level?
Well, first and foremost, I'd say it's crucial to learn about your local gun laws. Find out what your elected official stances are on these issues. Knowledge is power, as they say.
Okay, so knowledge first, but then what? How do you actually put that knowledge into action?
There are so many ways. You can attend city council meetings, write to your representatives, join community organizations that focus on gun safety or gun rights. There are groups out there for every perspective on this issue. Find one that aligns with your values and get involved.
I think a lot of people get intimidated by the political process. They might think that their individual actions won't really make a difference.
I get that. It can feel overwhelming. But change rarely happens overnight, right? It's a gradual process that requires consistent effort from lots of people. And honestly, getting involved in local politics is often much more accessible than trying to influence things at the national level.
That's a good point. You're more likely to have direct contact with your local representatives. Your vote carries more weight in local elections, too.
Exactly. It's easy to feel powerless when you're thinking about national politics, but at the local level, you really can shape the conversation and influence policy decisions.
Okay, so I'm getting fired up about local action. But how does this connect back to what we learned about the omitted clauses, specifically the one about the presumption of possession? Does that have local implications as well?
It definitely could. While that specific clause we talked about is part of federal law, the principle behind it that the government can make assumptions about how you obtained a firearm, even without direct evidence, could easily seep into legal arguments and interpretations at the state level. Remember, state laws are often modeled after federal laws, so understanding these nuances at the federal level can give you a much deeper understanding of how similar concepts might be playing out in your own state.
So it's like what happens at the federal level can create a ripple effect that influences things in different states and local communities.
Precisely. That's why it's so crucial to be informed and engaged at all levels, from the federal level down to your own town or city. What might seem like a technical legal detail in the U.S. Code could have real-world consequences for how laws are enforced and interpreted in your community.
Wow, that's a powerful realization. So understanding the nuances of Chapter 44 is important in itself, but it also serves as a springboard for understanding the legal landscape in our own communities.
Exactly. Think of this deep dive as just the first step on a journey of understanding and engaging with firearm regulations. We've uncovered the complexities at the federal level. Now it's time to zoom in and explore how those complexities play out, or maybe even don't play out, in your own state and local laws.
Okay, so for our listener who's probably feeling overwhelmed and asking, where do I even begin? Well, it's a good first step, something concrete they can do.
I'd say a great place to start is by actually looking up your state and local laws on firearms. A lot of states have their legal codes online, and most towns and cities have websites where you can find local ordinances. You can also just contact your local representatives or city council members and ask them about specific laws or their positions on gun control.
So step one, arm yourself with information.
Yeah.
All right, then what? How do you actually turn that knowledge into action?
Once you have a better understanding of the legal landscape, the next step is to find ways to get involved. If you're passionate about a particular aspect of gun regulation, do some research and see who's working on that issue in your area. There are probably local organizations, advocacy groups, or even just individual community members who are already engaged in this conversation. Reach out to them, ask questions, offer your support.
It's about finding that entry point, that place where your personal interests and the needs of your community intersect, right?
Exactly. It might be attending a town hall meeting, volunteering with a local organization, writing letters to the editor, or even just having conversations with your neighbors and friends about these issues. All of these actions, even the ones that seem small, can contribute to a larger movement for change.
I love that. It's so easy to get discouraged and think that one person can't make a difference, but you're right. It's all about those small actions adding up over time. It's like that saying, think globally, act locally. But in this case, it's think federally, act locally. We might not be able to single-handedly change Chapter 44, but we can definitely work to create safer communities, one town, one city at a time.
I completely agree. The more we understand about how laws are made and enforced, the more empowered we are to advocate for the kind of world we want to live in, starting right here in our own backyards.
I feel like this deep dive hasn't just been about understanding a specific law. It's been a lesson in civic engagement.
That's a great way to put it. And I hope our listeners are feeling inspired to take what they've learned and use it to make a difference in their communities.
Well said. So to wrap up this part of our deep dive, I want to reiterate that point. Knowledge is power, but only if we use it. So go out there, learn about the laws in your area, get involved, and make your voice heard. We'll be back soon to continue this fascinating exploration. Okay, so we've spent a lot of time talking about the ins and outs of Chapter 44, really digging into those legal details, but I think it's time to bring it all home, you know?
I agree. Let's connect the dots for our listeners and talk about what this all means for them, practically speaking.
Exactly. Like, how does understanding all this legal stuff actually help them navigate the world of firearms and the law in their own lives? What's the takeaway?
I think one of the biggest takeaways is that while federal laws provide a foundation, the specifics of how firearms are regulated, how safety is promoted, how communities deal with gun violence, a lot of that really happens at the state and local level.
So even if things aren't changing at the federal level as quickly as some people might like, there's still a lot that can be done in our own communities to make a difference.
Absolutely. Think about things like safe storage laws.
Yeah.
The federal laws might have some basic standards, but it's your local ordinances that will determine the specifics, you know, like, do you need a lockbox? Where can you keep guns in relation to kids? That kind of thing. And those local laws are what your local police are actually going to enforce.
So knowing this, our listener could think, okay, what are the exact rules where I live? And if they don't seem strong enough, who can I contact to try to change them?
Exactly. And it goes beyond just storage, too. Think about things like gun shows or private sales. Federal law might have some requirements, but your state or even your county could have additional rules about background checks, waiting periods, record keeping, all sorts of things. It's really important to understand the local context.
I'm starting to see the bigger picture here. It's almost like federal law is the basic framework, but then all the details, the really specific rules that affect people day to day, those get filled in at the state and local level.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. It's like a house needs a good, solid foundation, but you also need well-built walls and windows and a roof, right? It's all connected. And I think effective firearm regulation is kind of like that, too. It needs that combination of federal oversight and tailored local approaches to really work. It can't just be one or the other.
This makes me think back to something we talked about earlier about those omitted clauses from Chapter 44.
Yeah.
You know, the ones that aren't actually printed in the law anymore.
Yeah.
Even if they're not explicitly there, could those ideas still be influencing what happens in courts, especially at the local level?
It's certainly possible. Legal precedent, meaning how courts have interpreted laws in the past, can be very influential, even if the original wording of a law has changed or is, you know, missing in the current version.
Right. So those old interpretations could still be hanging around like ghosts in the legal machine.
Exactly. And that's why understanding things like those omitted clauses, like the one about the presumption from possession, can give you a deeper awareness of potential legal arguments that might come up, even if those clauses aren't explicitly mentioned. It's like having a secret decoder ring for the legal system.
I love that analogy. Okay, so we've given our listeners a lot to think about today. We've explored the complexities of federal firearms laws, dug into the history, uncovered some hidden clauses, and talked about the importance of local action. But if they were only going to remember one thing from this whole deep dive, what would you say it should be?
I think the one key takeaway is this. If you're passionate about firearm policy, don't just focus on the federal level. Get involved locally. That's where you can have the most direct and immediate impact on the laws that shape your community. Find out what the rules are in your city or town, connect with local organizations that are working on these issues, and make your voice heard. Your voice really does matter, especially at the local level.
Couldn't have said it better myself. That's a fantastic note to end on. This has been a truly eye-opening deep dive, I think. We've gone beyond just understanding a specific law. We've really explored how the legal system works and how individuals can engage with it to create change.
And that's what it's all about, isn't it? Empowering people with knowledge so they can make a difference in their own communities.
Well said. A huge thank you to all our listeners for joining us on this incredible journey through the world of federal firearms laws. We hope you learned something new, feel inspired to take action, and maybe even discovered a newfound passion for civic engagement. Remember, knowledge is power, especially when you use it to create a better, safer world for yourself and your community. Keep those questions coming, and until next time, stay curious.